Your dad was John McCain.
Yes. My dad was a huge music fan. I'm going to tell you right now, my dad loved Willie Nelson. And people are like, you can't say you like Willie Nelson because he dodged his taxes, blah, blah, blah. Well, he loved Willie Nelson. He did.
Everybody thinks they can do it. How can I become a professional wrestler? You really can't.
I pulled out the gun and I shot two times.
We have a complicated family. We were all raised to argue with each other with intensity, with passion, but also to love each other.
This is WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome to WTMJ Conversations. I'm your host, Libby Collins. Over the past 40 years, one man has almost single-handedly brought peregrine falcons back from the brink of extinction in Wisconsin. Greg Septon founded Wisconsin's Peregrine Falcon Recovery Project, and he also manages peregrine falcon nest boxes for We Energy's power plants. He's lectured all over the world, and he's here with us today. Greg, you spent a number of years with the Milwaukee Public Museum.
Yeah, I did. When I was a kid growing up in California, in addition to being interested in peregrines, I was very interested in museums and specifically working with birds at museums. And that was one of my life's goals when I was 10 or 11 years old. So one thing led to another, and eventually I got my way into the Milwaukee Public Museum, and I spent 26 years there, and I loved every minute of it. That's where the Peregrine Recovery Program initiated as part of my job at the museum.
What was it that fascinated you about birds when you were young?
It was walking into the bird exhibit hall at the L.A. County Museum. I just walked in there, and I'm just dumbfounded. This is what I want to do.
How did you relate to birds? I mean, they don't talk to you. They're not cuddly like a dog or a cat. What was it about birds that you found so interesting and compelling?
That's hard to say. I mean, when I walked into that hall, I felt this is what I want to do. And if it's something that you want to do, you obviously spend more time researching it. You get into it. You look at things. And you begin to try to decipher what it's all about. And I was always just fascinated with birds, with flight. I was very fascinated with raptors in particular because of their hunting abilities and their speed. Peregrines, of course, being at the top of that list. So one thing led to another. Of course, I was also became very interested in a lot of the birds that raptors preyed upon, specifically in some of the grouse and the ducks and the waterfowl and things that they preyed upon. So just one thing led to another. It was just basic curiosity.
Do you remember the first time you ever saw a prey bird in the wild?
Actually, it wasn't a prey bird. It was a scavenger, but it was a pretty important scavenger. When I was a kid in California, we lived up in the mountains the last few years we were there before we moved back to Wisconsin. And we had a California condor in the ravine up behind the house. And I was a little kid in seventh, eighth grade, wandering, looking at this big California condor. And it was pretty impressive.
And now most people have never seen one, at least in this part of the country. How large are they?
They're huge. They're probably, you know, 3.5 feet tall. They're big, massive wingspans. And again, I was this young kid that was, you know, seventh or eighth grade, just enamored with this big giant bird. And I was the only one there, no one else around. And so it was just me and the condor.
How close did you get?
Oh, I wasn't that close. He was sitting up high on a big dead eucalyptus tree.
And you just watched it?
Yeah, I just watched it.
You mentioned that you're also fascinated with the birds that are their food.
Well, some of them, prairie chickens in particular. I mean, you look out in the western states where you have prairie falcons. They kind of replace peregrine falcons in some areas. They hunt the wide open grasslands, and one of their prey species, of course, is prairie chickens, and they're birds I'm very interested in. That particular species has a long, colorful history here in Wisconsin. There was an organization that was formed back in the 60s called Timpanuchus cupidopinnatus, which is the Latin name for prairie chicken, and it was comprised of very wealthy individuals here in Milwaukee who got together to try to save the prairie chicken, and they did so by buying land in central Wisconsin. And every year they had their big bash downtown, and it was the social event of the year. And so it was quite a big deal early on. And when I first started at the museum, that organization was still high and mighty. I mean, there are a lot of conservation organizations across the country today, but back then that was one of the first. And there were a lot of people obviously there that were fairly well-heeled that would help me out with peregrines early on. And it was to those people that I preached my concept and my ideas for bringing them back.
What exactly brought the peregrine falcon to near extinction?
Shortly after World War II, the pesticide DDT was spread widely across the world, basically, to control agricultural insect pests. And that was a poison that worked its way up the food chain. The smaller birds would eat the insects, and that would bioaccumulate in their bodies. And the peregrines or raptors would come along and consume those songbirds, and they would consume all the poison that was in the songbirds. So it worked its way up through the food chain. And eventually, it caused eggshell thinning and neurological issues with peregrines, again, with other raptors. And after a number of years of eggshell thinnings, the eggs wouldn't hatch. They were breaking during incubation. So by the early 60s, they were gone. They were extirpated east of the Mississippi, and their numbers were drastically reduced throughout the rest of North America. So we went for almost 24 years without any peregrines nesting in Wisconsin, and captive breeding projects ensued throughout the country, and I got to know some of the breeders. And of course, Tom Cade out at Cornell University headed up the Eastern Peregrine Recovery Program. And eventually we worked our way east here, and one thing led to another, and people came across and had a few dollars. And I talked to the president of We Energies at the time, and I said, this is my idea. Could we do this at your power plants? And he said, yeah, let's give it a shot.
Coming up at WTMJ Conversations.
Plants are generally located along shorelines of rivers and lakes. They use the water to cool the turbines. Peregrines historically migrate up and down shoreline.
How did Greg Septon from Wisconsin's Peregrine Falcon Recovery Project attract the birds to the places where they wanted them to nest?
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm Libby Collins. We're talking with Greg Septon, who founded Wisconsin's Peregrine Falcon Recovery Project. Why power plants? Why are they such an attraction for these falcons?
Power plants are generally located along shorelines of rivers and lakes. They use the water to cool the turbines. Peregrines historically migrate up and down shorelines of rivers and lakes. So you've got all these power plants, which are basically human-built cliffs. Peregrines nest on cliffs overlooking bodies of water. For the most part, like the Mississippi River, the Wisconsin River, the Door Peninsula. What we had along the western shore of Lake Michigan, again, which is a major migration route, there were no natural cliffs, but now we have all these power plants. And as far as peregrines are concerned, these are human-built cliffs. They're big, tall structures along the shorelines, and if you provide a nest box for them, they're quite happy to nest there.
Describe what a nest box is.
They vary in size and shape. Most of the ones we use are about 3x4x3. They've got about 4 inches of washed, rounded pea gravel in the inside. Peregrines don't make a nest. They make what's called a scrape. It's a shallow bowl-like depression. So the peregrines will come in there and they'll use their feet and they'll hollow out a little shallow bowl in the gravel, and that's where they'll lay their eggs. And then in the front of the nest box, about 10 inches above that, we have a deck. And on top of that deck is AstroTurf. And I call that the elevated safety deck because historically, urban nesting peregrines are number one cause of losses was premature fledging. These birds would nest in these buildings, they'd nest in power plants, but they'd get precariously close to the edge of the building. In a storm or wind or rain, they could get blown off. They'd fall to their death before they could fly. So the first year we had peregrines nesting in Wisconsin, it was now the U.S. Bank building. I watched them and I realized they couldn't jump 10 inches until they were almost 4 weeks of age. So that fall, I built a prototype deck and installed it in the nest box at the U.S. Bank, covered it with AstroTurf, and we have not lost one falcon since then. So they work. What happens is the peregrines can't jump that high, so I built a deck to prevent them from getting out of the nest box, to prevent them from getting blown off the buildings. It's a simple fix, and it's worked wonders.
I want to go back to when you originally got involved in this project. How did you decide it would be easy to attract the falcons to some of the areas where you wanted to set up the nest? I mean, that was not a sure thing, was it?
I didn't know it was going to be easy. I didn't think it was going to be easy. I knew it was going to take time, and it did take time. It took years. I mean, we were fortunate to have one pair nest the following year here in Milwaukee, but beyond that, it took a long time until the year 2000 before we had 10 pairs nesting in the state. When we started out with nothing, we had to buy these captive-produced young falcons and release them through a process called hacking. You get the young when they're about 3 weeks of age. You put them in these large, like big nest boxes, but they have bars on the front so they can't escape. And you feed them through a tube, through a chute, through the top. You drop quail down through the chute so they can't imprint on us. We don't want them to know where the food's coming from. And until they're fully fledged, until they're ready to fledge at about 35 to 42 days of age, we provide food for them every day. Then at that point, we'd lock them in the back of the hack box in what's called a hide. I'd remove the bars from the front of the box, and I had a pulley system set up so I could remotely open the door and release them. Some would hang out in the hack box for a week or 10 days. Some would split right away. We then had what are called hack boards. We had yellow boards that we tied off on rooftops around Milwaukee. The biggest area we had for hack boards was the NML building, a nice big flat roof below the U.S. Bank. The hack boards were painted yellow, and every night I would go and I'd tie out quail, from a game farm that we'd killed and froze, and tie out quail for them. And while they were in the hack box, every time we'd drop quail from that chute on the top, it would fall on a yellow board. So they were imprinted on yellow boards and quail. So when they did take their first flights, the first things they would see as they flew were yellow boards and quail. So we had to make sure they would find food until they learned to hunt on their own, which would take a month or more. So we had to go out every night and tie food out for them. We'd tie out dead quail for them so they had plenty to eat. And then eventually we had them color marked with spray paint on each wing, different colors, so we could identify them at a distance. So we had a head count. We knew who was surviving, who was lost. Kept doing that until they moved out on their own and dispersed, which was usually by the middle of September.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
And came down at about 200 and some odd miles an hour and smacked the turkey vulture, and it dropped about 300 feet. The female went back up. The second time she hit it, it fell to its death.
Greg Septon from Wisconsin's Peregrine Falcon Recovery Project talks about how falcons work in teams to kill their prey.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
I'm your host, Libby Collins. Let's return to our conversation with Greg Septon, the founder of Wisconsin's Peregrine Falcon Recovery Project. It took, as you said, almost 15 years before you actually said, this is going to work.
Yeah. One of the things I did before I put any boxes up on the lakefront, I had a friend who was a pilot. We flew from the Illinois border all the way up into Door County, and I photographed every tall human-built structure along the lakefront. Then went back and met with the owners of all those properties and asked for permission to put up nest boxes. In many cases, tried to get them to sponsor the boxes because it's expensive. That's why I formed that small nonprofit, to raise money to buy quail to feed these birds and to buy captive-produced chicks that we could release and to cover mileage and expenses for building boxes and so on. So it took some time, but today all the sites along the lakefront are occupied with nesting peregrines.
On those early days, did you find you were attracting other birds besides peregrines?
Yes. At the Port Washington Generating Station, we had great horned owls try to nest one year, and that nest failed. We also had them try to nest at the Oak Creek Power Plant one year, and they produced two young. And when that happened, we built a new nest box a few hundred yards away, and the peregrine moved into that box later in the season. Owls nest in January and February, so they nest really early. So by the time they're young fledged, the peregrines are in and they're nesting, so they have different nesting.
Do you still have that happen?
Interestingly enough, we had a pair of great horned owls move into the nest box at the Aztalan facility up in Jefferson this spring. They laid two eggs, and I thought, oh, this is not going to be good, and the peregrines were there every day. Long story short, the peregrines won. The owls are gone. I don't know if they killed them, if they moved on their own, but the eggs are gone, the owls are gone, and there's a pair of peregrines in there incubating four eggs right now.
Will peregrines kill other birds? I mean, other than the ones that they're using for
absolutely.
Food.
Absolutely. I've seen peregrines kill horned owls. See, and one of the situations we had at the Oak Creek Power Plant is the owls ruled the roost at night. So that peregrine nest at the Oak Creek Power Plant actually failed that year. The owls were there early on in January. They laid eggs. They produced three young, I believe it was. We built the other box up the other side of the power plant away from them. When the owls were awake at night, the peregrines would leave their nest box because if the owls came in the nest box at night, the peregrines would get killed. So at night, the peregrines would leave their eggs alone and they didn't hatch because they weren't being incubated fully. So that nest failed. But to get even, the peregrines killed one of the young owls when it fledged. So the peregrines were awake during the day, and early in the morning, one of the young owls made its first flight. That was its last flight. I've also seen peregrines take out turkey vultures in downtown Milwaukee.
Those things are huge.
Yeah, they are. I was actually sitting next to the nest box at the U.S. Bank one spring, and I was going to go in to band the youngsters, and the adults were there, and they took off flying. Normally, they'll protect the young, but they took off flying, and I looked, and there was a turkey vulture, and they went up, and they circled up above it, and the adult pair hunted as a pair, as a team, and the male was harrying the turkey vulture, just riding its butt, basically, while the female went up higher and higher, and she went into it. She did a rollover and into a stoop and came down at about 200 and some odd miles an hour and smacked the turkey vulture, and it dropped about 300 feet. It regained its composure, and while it was regaining its composure, the peregrines repeated that first cycle. The female went back up. The second time she hit it, it fell to its death.
You mentioned they were a pair, and I want to talk a little bit about the actual behavior of peregrine falcons. Do they mate for life?
They will mate for as long as both adults survive. They have a very strong affinity to the nest site, and if both survive, they'll both return to the same nest site. If one of the pair is lost, the survivor will do everything they can to attract a new mate, and they're generally pretty successful.
What is their behavior like? How does it differ from other raptors?
It doesn't differ that much. I mean, all your raptors go through courtship displays in the spring. They're obviously different for different species, but for peregrines here in Wisconsin, they're generally back on territory by February. Many of these birds are here year-round now. Historically, they all migrated, but the birds that we have here now have adapted after living in urban areas like Milwaukee and Green Bay, Sheboygan, Manitowoc, and some of these birds are here year-round. It doesn't make sense for them to migrate and go through all the rigors and dangers of flying down to Central and South America when all their needs are right back here at home. Plus, by not migrating, they're already by their nest box and they can get started nesting earlier than the migrants would. Having said that, we do have some of these peregrines that migrate. We had a peregrine that was from the Port Washington Generating Station that ended up down in Nicaragua. I had another falcon I banded as a baby up in Menasha that ended up down in Venezuela. So they do migrate, and the name peregrine means wanderer, and they can cover some tremendous distances. But again, having said that, a lot of these birds are homebodies today.
You mentioned the banding, and you personally do that. You were so careful earlier to talk about how you didn't want to imprint or let them think that there was a food source coming from a human being. How do you get close enough to band them and yet not in any way interfere with their life?
Yeah, the entire banding process from start to finish takes about an hour. That includes getting up onto the roof for the buildings and accessing the nest box. I band all the young when they're between about 18 and 24 days of age. They're downy. They haven't grown their flight feathers or tail feathers yet. They're big, fluffy, downy. They look like a big, giant marshmallow, basically. And they can't fly. We take them out of the nest box into a little air kennel. I bring them in the building where it's safe, away from the adults. And it takes about 5 minutes per bird to band them. All the data is recorded in a notebook. And within 15 minutes after they're banded, they're back in the nest box. And within an hour, they don't even know what's happened. The adults are back. Of course, the adults are very defensive while we're doing this. But once it's over with, they calm down within 15 to 20 minutes. The young don't even really know what had happened. All they know is they've got new jewelry.
Have you ever had situations where the adults then refuse to let the fledglings back in the nest?
Never. Never. They always accept their young back.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
Somebody had shot her. She had a broken wing. She was sent up to the Raptor Center at the University of Minnesota. So I got a call from the Raptor Center, and they said, you want to get your bird back? And I said, absolutely.
The founder of Wisconsin's Peregrine Falcon Recovery Project, Greg Septon, tells us the story of Atlanta the Falcon.
Now more of WTMJ Conversations.
And I'm Libby Collins. Our guest today is Greg Septon. He's the founder of Wisconsin's Peregrine Falcon Recovery Project. How many birds have you banded through these last 40 years?
Over 1,500 now.
And how many of those birds are still surviving?
Peregrines have a first-year mortality rate. 50 to 70% of these birds are not going to make it through their first year.
What happens to them?
It's anything. It could be disease. They could fly into a wire. They could just not have what it takes. They could eat a poisoned bird. They could get bird flu, which is a big issue right now. There's a lot of things that can kill peregrines out there. They could be hit by an owl. An owl could take them at night. Lots of things that could kill them. So again, 50 to 70% of these birds are not going to make it through their first year. Having said that, some of these birds, they don't normally start nesting until they're 2 to 3 years of age. And I've had some birds that have lived to be 14, 15 years of age. But, you know, 3 to 7 years is about an average lifespan for a peregrine.
Do any of those young return to their original nest to nest themselves?
Rarely. I've had it happen maybe a handful of times, but it's pretty rare. They generally go off. When they disperse, they go off and they look for what they're going to need. They're going to need a territory. They're going to need to find a mate. And they're going to want to reproduce. And that's what they look for.
How do they select, though, which place they want to be? Obviously, you've got a lot of different nests throughout this area. Do you sometimes see pairs of peregrines looking almost like they're shopping for a new home?
Prospecting, absolutely. I had a pair. It was the Landmark on the Lake apartment complex over on Prospect Avenue, and I got a call when I was at the museum one morning. Young lady who was at the entry to the building, the desk, the visitor center, whatever you want to call it, called. She said, I think we've got falcons by our building. You want to come and take a look? And I said, sure. I drove over and I parked on Prospect. I looked up and sure as heck, there was a pair of peregrines circling the building. So I said, can I get up on the roof for a while? And she said, yeah. So I went up on the roof and looked around and I found a nice little ledge in the corner that was protected. And I said, would you mind if I came back and put a little wooden tray with some pea gravel in the corner over there? And she says, I don't care. So I said, all right. I went back to the museum and slapped together a nest tray and drilled some holes and had a bucket of pea gravel and went back and put the little tray in the corner of the ledge where the window washing unit would go. And I went back to my truck across on Prospect and I looked upstairs and I watched. It was a 28-story building. I'm watching and watching, and the pair came back and they landed on the ledge. And you could see them looking down at the nest tray, and they went down in the nest tray. They came back. They copulated. And they flew off here, did a couple more loops. 2 days later, we had the first egg in that nest tray. She was ready to lay, and they were probably not necessarily panic mode, but she was so close to laying, and they had no place to nest.
How long do the eggs incubate?
33 to 35 days.
Do the male and the female take turns?
They do take turns. And some of these males are just crazy incubators. They love to incubate. They're in there as much or more than the females. In fact, at some of the sites, the males actually are on the eggs at night instead of the females when it's colder, which is unusual. But I've seen that many, many times now.
Going back to when you first started this project, what was it like the first egg that you saw these falcons lay?
Let me go back one step further to the first successful nest we had. I didn't see the eggs being laid, but this was back at the, it was the first Wisconsin Center, now it's the U.S. Bank. The old hack box, I removed the bars on the front. As I mentioned, I built that deck in the front, and we saw peregrines around. That was 87. In 88, we saw peregrines around, and I looked in the nest box. There was nothing in there, and the two peregrines we saw here were both juveniles, and they don't normally nest till they're 2 to 3 years of age. I thought, well, we've got a couple of youngsters that came back from the previous year that we'd done the releases. Well, with binoculars and spotting scopes and crawling around on ledges, I soon discovered by reading band numbers that those birds were not birds I'd released. The female was named Madonna. She was from Rochester, Minnesota. The male was named MacArthur. He was from Fort Sheridan, Illinois. And I thought, well, that's weird. One came from Minnesota, one came from Illinois. And they found the only nest box in the state. And they were hanging around. Long story short, I made one of my visits up to the nest box, and I opened the door, and here were two maybe 5 or 6 day old chicks. They had laid eggs, unbeknownst to me. I went back and checked, and they produced two young. And they were both juveniles. It was one of the first recordings of two juvenile peregrines producing young. Well, the thing is, there were no adults to chase them off. These were teenage parents. No adults to chase them off. They had the world by the you-know-what, and they nested. Nobody to bother them. Normally, when you've got adults on a site and a juvenile shows up, they chase them off.
How excited were you, though, when you first saw that and realized that this was working?
I wanted to go downstairs to the bar and have a drink. This is a pretty cool thing to celebrate. Of course, they weren't open early in the morning like that, but this is pretty nice. Pretty nice.
Greg, you have a special story about one particular falcon.
Her name was Atlanta. She was produced up in Green Bay. In November of that year, I got a call. Atlanta was found shot in Trenton, Indiana. Somebody had shot her. She had a broken wing. She was sent up to the Raptor Center at the University of Minnesota. They pinned her wing. And she was up there until the following spring in May. So I got a call from the Raptor Center, and they said, you want to get your bird back? And I said, absolutely. So I went to Mitchell Field expecting to see her. Someone had misplaced the air kennel and put it on a cabinet on top of a countertop at the airport and forgot that it was supposed to go on the flight to Milwaukee. Long story short, they got it on the very last flight. My plan was I was going to take Atlanta back to the courthouse in Racine. There was a lone male there. I was going to play matchmaker and let her go. Maybe she'd like that male. So we went up on the roof, and I opened up the kennel. Atlanta walked out, and she took off and took two big loops around the courthouse, had no interest in the male. And she flew straight across Lake Michigan, completely out of sight. I thought, well, she's gone. The following spring, I got a call from the guys at the Oak Creek Power Plant that there's a big peregrine battle going on. In the spring, when they're fighting for territory or fighting to find a mate, they will fight to the death at times. And that's exactly what happened. Eventually, in the end, I found the female that lost that fight. And I didn't know who the female was that came in and did this. And I got up there, and sure enough, it was Atlanta.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
In all circumstances, all situations are limited by available suitable habitat, which are the cliffs or the human-built structures.
Greg Septon, the founder of Wisconsin's Peregrine Falcon Recovery Project, tells me whether or not he thinks the work they do will change the behavior of the birds.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back to our conversation with Greg Septon, the founder of Wisconsin's Peregrine Falcon Recovery Project. I'm your host, Libby Collins. When you talk about the peregrines, there's so many other birds of prey and raptors that come to the Midwest. Have you ever thought about trying to attract something other than falcons to some of these sites?
No, I'm going to stick with peregrines. And the reason being is even historically, even prior to the DDT era and the eggshell thinning and prior to their extirpation here, they were always rare. They are one of the rarest raptors in the country. They're limited by available nest sites. And historically, those were the cliffs on the Mississippi River, the cliffs overlooking the Wisconsin River and the Door Peninsula here in Wisconsin. That was it. So historically, we probably never had more than a couple dozen pairs of peregrines in the entire state. Last year, we had 40 pairs that produced 103 young. So they'll always be rare. They're dependent on available nest sites, whether they're natural cliffs or human-built. So I think if we want to maintain these numbers, we need to be vigilant. Almost 70% of the peregrines last year in Wisconsin were still produced at urban sites, and those urban sites need to be maintained. They need to be looked after. And one of the big issues I've got these days is replacing sites. Some of the old coal-fired power plants have been taken down, gone offline. I've got the old Fredert Malt Complex here in West Allis. That's gone. I had a nest there. There are a number of other sites around the state that are being torn down. And when they're paper mills, I've had sites of paper mills are being torn down. So when I learned that a site that's been established, at, let's say paper mill is being torn down, I spent a lot of effort looking around that region or that area for another possible nest site. Another tall structure along the river or nearby. And then I saw going or reinventing the wheel, meeting with the landowners or the property owners and talking to them and trying to convince them that this is a good place for peregrines and here's why it's important. So you lose a site, you try to gain a site. You lose a site, you try to gain a site. Sometimes you lose two sites and just gain one. So you need to be vigilant if you want to keep the numbers up.
Have you ever been concerned that you're changing their natural behavior?
No, I'm really not, because it was back in the 1700s, 1800s that peregrines were recorded nesting on a cathedral over in Europe. So they've been nesting on human-built structures for centuries. It just it suits their purpose. It fulfills all their needs. They don't care if it's human-built or natural.
How widespread are these peregrines throughout the United States?
Well, for the world, peregrines are found on every continent except Antarctica. There are different subspecies, obviously. And in all circumstances, all situations are limited by available suitable habitat, which are the cliffs or the human-built structures.
Have there been similar objectives in other areas to create these kinds of nests?
Absolutely. Across the Midwest, across the West, there are nest boxes all around the country. Back in the early 90s, I worked with the Department of Interior's U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Office of International Affairs, and they had me go over to Moscow and Russia three times, and we set up an urban peregrine nesting program in Russia, and there's now 5 to 6 pairs nesting there in downtown Moscow.
You have been all over the world, too. You've done a number of expeditions. Were those all dealing with peregrine falcons?
Oh, no. I did a lot of work on exhibits. A lot of these expeditions and trips I was on were basically for collecting birds for scientific collections or for the exhibits.
What were some of the most unusual birds you've ever found on these expeditions?
Bare-throated tiger herons in Costa Rica and keel-billed toucans and Arctic loons up in Barrow, Alaska, and king eiders, spectacle eiders. Just lots of things you wouldn't normally see on a daily basis. You might never see in a lifetime, and So I was fortunate enough to be able to see all these.
Yeah, you still come back to the falcons.
Yeah, I do.
One thing that I find really interesting about them is the way they capture their prey.
Peregrines will adapt to a situation. I've seen them, first of all, go back to their hunting behavior. They'll go up high. They hunt birds in the open air, and they'll go into a stoop. When they see their prey, they'll do a rollover, go into a stoop where they can achieve speeds of well over 200 miles an hour. And either if it's a small bird, they'll grab it in midair. A larger bird, they will hit it and stun it and knock it down, and then maybe knock it down a second time before it falls to the ground, then go down and eat it. But I've also seen peregrines, again, that are very opportunistic. There was a male peregrine at the power plant in Sheboygan, and there was a pair of pigeons that had nested back in a little cubby along an I-beam, and they were back in about 2 feet. And I watched the male peregrine walk down the I-beam, go back into the little cubby and grab a squab and come walking back out with it and take it back up to his young.
Just that simple.
Just walked in, like grabbing a burger off the counter.
Does that bother you when you see those things happen?
Why should they work hard when there's an easy meal?
So you're rooting for the falcons?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of pigeons. There's only 40 pairs of nesting peregrines. There's probably 40 million pigeons in the state.
How long do you see yourself doing this? Because I know just recently you were honored by We Energies at the Wisconsin Humane Society, and Governor Evers was there and gave you a proclamation. How long will you continue to do this?
I'd like to continue as long as my health holds on, as long as I can, you know, and then I don't foresee any issues with that right now, but I would love to see someone come along who's got energy and some passion and commitment. This is not the kind of thing you're going to spend a year or two doing and move on. So you need to have someone who's going to stick to it and stick with it and find the wherewithal to make it all happen.
Do you have people working with you now?
It's hard to find people that want to work for very little money, if no money. Volunteers, God bless them, but I've had some volunteers where, you know, they say they're going to be there and you show up and they're not. So you need to have someone. We all need to make a living. We all need to eat. We all need to, you know, have a roof over our heads. So it has to be a situation where someone can make enough money to cover their basic needs.
What kind of person are you looking for?
I'm looking for someone who's got some passion, someone who's very much into raptors, someone who's got some experience that has done some things where they've got not a lengthy proven track record, but a track record that's proven enough to let me know that this person's serious.
Do they have to be knowledgeable in ornithology?
Knowledgeable in bird behavior. Have some what I always call bird sense. It's something that it's hard to describe, but I can see it in a person when they have it. It's hard to explain. I've talked about this. There's only a handful of people in the world I've talked to when I say bird sense, they know what I mean. It's being able to read a bird, being able to understand not necessarily what they're thinking, but what their behavior implies. Just a sense you get when you're around them about what's right, what's wrong, what they need, what they don't eat. I can look at a bird and tell you when they're going to lay an egg within an hour. So it's just having bird sense. And it's a tough commodity to come by.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
I opened the door a crack at that. The female wasn't there. I thought I'd take a quick look. She came in from behind me and just raked it.
Greg Septon from Wisconsin's Peregrine Falcon Recovery Project warns, never get close to a mama and their babies.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
I'm Libby Collins. Today's conversation is with Greg Septon, the founder of Wisconsin's Peregrine Falcon Recovery Project. Are raptors somewhat different than other varieties of birds? They're very prey-driven.
More so with raptors, all birds have to eat. And very frankly, you know, when you see, for instance, some of these, like prairie chickens in central Wisconsin, you see them walking a mother with her chick hunting grasshoppers. They're basically hunting, too. They're little dinosaurs hunting grasshoppers. And they're no different than a peregrine hunting a pigeon or a songbird. It's a different flight, it's different behavior, different method, but they're all hunting to eat.
So you're looking for someone, maybe multiple people, perhaps, who have the same passion.
Yeah, and someone who looks at it as something they're not going to do for a year or two, someone that wants to spend a long time doing it and maybe bring other people in to continue when their time is done, you know.
But what do they have to do? I mean, physically, you're talking about you're up and down in buildings, you're taking baby birds out of their nest and banding them. I mean, there seems to be certain skills that are needed.
Bird sense. Just bird sense. I mean, to read your surroundings, understand what could happen, what may happen, what might likely will happen. I am proud of the fact that of all the birds I've handled and all the birds I've banded in 40 years, I've never injured a bird. I've never lost a bird. It's because you pay attention. Peregrines can cause you a heap of hurt. If you get hit by a peregrine doing 200 miles an hour, they can cause you some damage. I mean, I've had my ear torn open by one. But in all these years, I've only been hit 3 or 4 times. In every instance, it was my own fault for not paying attention.
How did that ear situation happen?
There was an access door out to the deck or the roof where I had that small nest tray. And you should wear a hard hat. Always. And I opened the door a crack at that. The female wasn't there. I thought I'd take a quick look. She came in from behind me and just raked it.
Because she was protecting her nest.
Absolutely. Her young were from me to you away.
What do you wish people knew about birds that you don't think the majority of people do?
The majority of people don't realize that we've lost 50 to 70% of the birds we had here 30 or 40 years ago. When I was a kid growing up, you'd go out into the woods in the morning. It was just alive with birds calling. Even in the last 15 years, I mean, you get up in the morning and you can hear robins singing. And during migration, you'll hear orioles and you always hear cardinals singing and some of the sparrows, obviously, when they're coming through, and warblers on migration. But the richness is gone. The numbers are down. The audible experience is dwindling. And it's because of habitat loss. It's big time because of pesticides. The neonicotides that they're spraying on a lot of the crops that are wiping out the monarchs and other butterflies, other insects. Again, it's that food chain. It works its way up through the food chain. And we're not stopping it. We just continue doing it. There's, you know, the agricultural industry wants to produce food, and so be it. They need to produce food. But there's got to be better ways of doing it. I mean, the organic industry is taking off. More and more people are buying organic. And I'd like to see that expand more and more and more. The bigger producers are still going to use pesticides.
What about the average homeowner? What can they do to keep these birds safe and healthy?
Best thing they can do is not spray their yards with all these lawn care companies that come by and spray all this garbage. And they put the little yellow flag saying, don't let your kids or dogs walk here for 24 hours. Well, you know what, folks? After 24 hours, that stuff is still on the grass. It doesn't go away. And it's affecting everybody. I mean, your dog's going to go out there. Our neighbor's dog across the street, you know, they spray all the time. Their dog died of cancer. We don't spray. We've got signs up in our natural yard, but don't spray. And I try to get the message out to people that you can start small. You can do that. You can have a wild yard instead of having, you know, a finely trimmed lawn. Plant wildflowers, plant natural grasses, you know, put up birdhouses. That's what we've done. We still have grass, but we don't spray. You can pull a few dandelions if they get in the way and let clover grow instead of grass. Clover is great. You don't have to cut it very often. The rabbits love it, and your whole yard's green. You know, it's just easy stuff that anybody can do. And if you start small and it grows, it can have some impact.
Greg, I want to ask you about those four falcon boxes that We Energies has right now with cameras, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can watch what's going on there.
Absolutely.
What is it we should be looking for right now?
The first eggs of the season, well, I'd be watching. All the estimated hatch dates are listed on the We Energies website, so they can go on and look at the hatch dates and start watching a day or so before. Then they can watch the eggs hatch. I mean, I've been able to watch these eggs hatch live, which is pretty cool.
And watch the baby birds grow.
Watch them grow. Watch the adults come in and take care of them and feed them. And we can actually, once the webcams are going, when the young are to the point where they jump up on the deck, they're ready to fledge, you can watch them take their first flights, which is kind of cool too.
Greg, you have some special things you're going to be doing this year, I understand.
Well, one of the things I'm excited about this year is one of the things I've always wanted to do is to put radios, satellite transmitters or small radios on these peregrines. And you can do that when you capture an adult. You can put a harness on them that doesn't impinge on their ability to fly. You can put a harness on them with a small solar-powered transmitter on their back. And that's been the standard way of tracking peregrines for many, many years. And my problem is, most of the birds I'm working with are young birds. These are birds in the nests, and they're downy, and they haven't got feathers growing yet. So I don't want to take a chance at trapping them when they're flying in the cities because of all the city hazards, trucks and cars and wires and everything else they can get hurt in. My dream was always to find some way of attaching a transmitter to a band. I'm banding anyways. Why not have a small transmitter that fits on a band? Well, they've got them. They came out with them last year. There's a company called CTT out east. They're small transmitters. They're about as big as my little fingernail, and they clip on the back of the color band. And not only can you track them through the MODIS system, you can track them through the cellular network. You know what the Apple AirTags are like? That's
sure.
What these are like, but they're for peregrines. So I can put these on baby birds on the bands. I know there's no harnesses. I'm not adversely affecting any feather growth. They're going to fledge normally. They're going to have these little tags on the back of their bands, and hopefully we'll learn all kinds of new things.
Have you ever thought about putting a camera on one of these falcons?
It's been done, but it's a big thing to do. I mean, they've had cameras on falcons and eagles and everything else, but I can't see any purpose in it. I mean, it's been done before. I don't want to hurt a bird. I don't want to do something that I don't need to do. But this is something that's going to allow me to find out a couple of very important things. Peregrines, as I mentioned, don't nest until they're 2 to 3 years of age normally. What do they do for this 2-3 years? We've got bands of some of these birds that are found down in Central and South America. We've got bands of birds that have been hit by cars or fly into a wire or found dead or die from bird flu. But the birds that survive to nest when they're 2 or 3 years old, where have they been for those 2 or 3 years? We don't know. Now we'll know.
Do you have any suspicions of what they're doing?
I think that some of these peregrines that do migrate, the ones that go down far south, Central and South America, they go down there because they're not tied to a nest site. Once they've nested, that's their home territory. Some of these birds that have home territories do migrate. We had a male that nested up on the northern shore of Lake Superior on a cliff. He spent every winter down in Austin, Texas on a building. That was his winter hangout. So some of these birds move out, some stay fairly close. again, this will allow us to find out exactly where they go and what they do.
Sowing their wild oats.
Yeah,
so to speak.
And I think what happens once these birds that go, if the birds that go down, it's a big if too, if the birds that go down to Central and South America survive and come back and establish a nest, do they also go back south again? I don't think so. I think they stay pretty close to home. There's no need to go back down there. As you said, spreading their wild oats, maybe, I don't know. They're not ready to breed yet, but they're certainly got a lot of wanderlust and they're ready to go and they're going to go where the wind blows and they've got nothing holding them back.
Greg Sefton, thank you so much for all you do.
Well, you're very welcome.
We've been talking with Greg Sefton. He's the man who started the Peregrine Falcon Project in Wisconsin over 40 years ago. We talked with him about his motivation for continuing to save these birds and also how they help the ecology here in Wisconsin. Now, we also have another thing we want to share with you, and that is that We Energies has a naming contest for its Peregrine Falcon chicks this year. And you can vote for your favorite WTMJ personality, like Jessica Tweet, Swoopy Max, Kristen Fly, Steve Scatweedy, Egg Matzik, Eric Birdstad, Eggy Lazaga, Flown Mercure, Vince Falcono, and the ever-popular Julia Feathers. Now, if you want to vote for any of our personalities to name a Falcon chick, all you have to do is go to WTMJ.com. And you'll also find a copy of this interview that you can share with your family and friends. And there's also a transcript courtesy of eCourt Reporters. For WTMJ Conversations, I'm Libby Collins.